I'm Cape.
And I'm Drew.
We're just two former student athletes who understand the game.
Not just on the court.
But in life.
At the end of the day, we just want to help.
Today's athletes and former just trying to find their way.
It's bigger than sports.
This is the Cape and Drew Podcast, the real TikTok. What's up, everybody? I'm Cape.
I'm Drew. And tonight we are back with part four of our series of See Black Women. Just wanted to focus on, you know, Black women doing exceptional things out here. And tonight we are fortunate enough to have Ms. Jennifer Williams, the athletic director for Alabama State University. So, Ms. Williams, how are you doing today?
I'm good. I'm good. You know, it's a busy time for us, but hey, we're here. We're healthy, so I can't complain.
And you know what? First things first, we, you know, recognize, you know, you're a former hooper, but that the holy grail of universities for us, because we're from North Carolina, and so we grew up. You got to pick Carolina, you got to pick Duke. So
exactly. You know what it is.
I was like, she hooped at Carolina? So that is just like, man, you got a special place in our hearts.
It don't matter. Hey, still respect. We know what that is over there.
Thank you. It was it was great. It was a great time.
No doubt. The first question we always ask, especially now, is just, you know, what have been, you know, your top three most positive things about being in quarantine, and then like the top three things that, you know, you're just over about being in quarantine?
So the top three, number one, just having more time with my family. You know, as an athletic director, we're constantly on the go, and I make it a point to try to travel with all of my teams, whether you're a revenue generating sport or if you're an Olympic sport. So being able to be home and just kind of chill out, as my daughter likes to say, that's kind of been the highlight of quarantine. You know, just, I guess, cooking more, because I eat out a lot. So I'll say owning in on my chef skills have been good for quarantine. And then just, you know, learning about the new technologies that are out there. I think this has pushed a lot of people out of their comfort zone to try new things and to be more open to technology and Zoom and Google Meet and just things we wouldn't have used if we would have been, or that maybe I wouldn't have used if I would have been on campus. So those are kind of like the top three, you know, stepping out of the comfort zone, family time, and Chef JT over here. So, but the worst part about it is that I like people. So I miss the interactions and I miss my student athletes. I miss that we are not competing right now, or that we did not compete in the spring. And now we're delayed for the fall. So those are kind of the negatives with it. But what else? Really the interaction. I just miss people. And I miss, you know, I would normally get a vacation and go somewhere. But I'm just like, Alabama, the Alabamians here, they're just not acting right now. So I'm going to stay put.
Everywhere.
But I'm not going anywhere. So that's really the travel during the summer, you know, family reunions. We had our family reunions. I had them both on my grandparents' side, maternal and paternal, and they were canceled. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of been the down part of it. But, you know, I tell people we're going to come out of COVID a lot stronger. I think it's his way, the man upstairs, whoever people pray to or believe in, telling us that we need to stay, sit down and be still for a second and, you know, kind of just more simpler things, be with our family. And, you know, it puts a lot in perspective. Like, I think a lot of people you hear have canceled 2020. I tell people, I haven't canceled. I haven't given up on 2020. Not yet. I think that we still, you know, it's things in perspective. I think you learn from this time in quarantine and you just come out and just focus on being a better person going into the next year.
Man, that technology piece, I swear to God, if I have to tell a person, would you put it on mute, man?
Yeah. Hit the mute button, please. Yes.
I just had to say, we had this orientation today and had it in the email. When you enter in, put it on mute. And we, old timer came in, he looked at the screen. I said, good morning to you.
And I get people that won't unmute. I'm like, we've been doing this. Like, you got to unmute too. But yeah.
One thing you said, though, about, you know, this year and the man upstairs or the woman upstairs or whatever you believe in, telling mm-hmm. us to chill out. Me and Drew talk about that, and that's something that, you know, our other guests kind of touch on too, is that I think that is the point of all of this. I think mm-hmm. it's a time, no matter what your profession is, and I, you know, we know being a coach, being an AD, or, you know, it requires you all to be on the road a lot. And so, you know, being home with your family and enjoying your kids and your spouse and just sitting still for a minute. And then mm-hmm. for us or for everybody, it's like, miss your profession. Because sometimes you got people that complain about their jobs all the time, or I hate this, or I hate, okay, mm-hmm. let me change some things up, take you away from
take it away.
Let me take it away so mm-hmm. you can, you know, appreciate it and be grateful for everything you have. So I'm with you, man. I think all of this is happening for a reason. And I think we're going to come out better on the other side for sure. So about your career path, we all know you played at probably the best institution besides VCU, Chapel Hill. So,
and we played VCU and we beat them too.
Did y'all?
School, so look. I just wanted to put that out there.
I'm not going to ask you what year. I'm not even going to ask.
Yeah, please don't do that.
But who was on the squad that year for VCU? Ooh, that was
I don't remember. Just know it's hard playing down there. I do know that. And an administrator from actually Carolina alum, used to be the AD there back, I think Teague Norwood, yeah, maybe a while ago.
He was the
AD. He's a Carolina grad.
Yeah, he was the AD.
Carolina grad.
Yeah. He's from, I forget where he's from, because he went to Minnesota after he left VCU.
Yep.
And has some things going on, but that's still okay.
We weren't going to bring that up. You know?
That's my guy. Because I think he was the AD when I was in grad school at VCU. Mm-hmm. But yeah, he was a solid dude. But yeah, small world. But anyway, you transitioned from being a student athlete to where you are now. And we always, Drew and I always thought that's one of the main reasons we started this podcast, was because we believe experiencing what we experienced, that transition from being a student athlete is just tough, you know, just finding your niche after the ball or whatever stops bouncing. So can you talk a little bit about your transition and your career path?
Absolutely. So, you know, while I was at Carolina, I knew that I never wanted to coach. I just did not have the patience, and I couldn't imagine dealing with 15 of me on a team. So I was just like, no, that's not it. But you didn't see, and you still don't see a lot of administrators who are African-American, people of color, female, in executive roles. I'm not talking about as academic advisors or, you know, in, you know, different other, you know, non-senior level positions. I'm talking about that's at the table. So I always knew that, you know, I wanted to be involved in sport, but just didn't know in what capacity. So I went to the television route. I was a journalism major at Carolina. I actually ended up getting a job at Fox Sports when I graduated in Atlanta. So moved to Hot Atlanta in, I'm not going to say the year, but moved to Atlanta. And I worked at Fox Sports for about a year and a half. And I had a postgraduate scholarship through the WBCA. It was the Robin Roberts Sports Communication Award. And I was able to utilize that, and I knew I wanted to go to an HBCU. I always wanted to go to an HBCU. I just was never recruited. And I really didn't. I'm from Michigan, so it's not any HBCUs there. I went to private school, so they're not telling you about HBCUs. And so I knew that going to North Carolina Central, like, I was going to go to an HBCU, and that was the one I wanted to go to. So I end up getting accepted to North Carolina Central in the ninth hour. I packed up my two-door Explorer and made a way from Atlanta to Durham. I had one of my classmates from Carolina. She was actually on the softball team, lived in Durham at the time. She let me crash with her for a few weeks until I was able to find somewhere to stay, but made it happen. And at that time, you know, I knew that I wasn't fulfilled working in television. I was good at it. You know, I had other gigs where I could have stayed in it, but it wasn't for me. I knew I wanted to get on a campus, be involved with student athletes. And so going back to grad school gave me the opportunity to really focus in on, you know, working with student athletes. And when you go to a Central, was transitioning from D2 to Division I when I came in. And so to be able to get that much hands-on experience, I wouldn't have gotten that if I would have went to Carolina for grad school or a Power Five, because it was a smaller department. So I probably got to be in conversations I maybe should not have been in as a GA, but it helped me a lot. So I'm going to meetings with, you know, the soft drink provider at the university at the time, and different meetings with the cell phone Verizon or AT&T, and just having that, being able to be there and be around those folks and hear the vernacular and what they're talking about, it really helped me kind of figure out, okay, I like working in development, I like fundraising, but I also like student athlete development. I like both of them because I care about the student athlete and their experience. And that was one reason why I chose to do my thesis on a student athlete mentoring program, because they didn't have that at Central. You know, when I was at Carolina, we were matched with, as freshmen, with a group. We had our own cohort. You know, it was football, women's basketball, all type of people, but pods of like six. And this was part of that mentoring, help you get acclimated to college. And so that made me want to create a program. And I think I called it Flight. I wrote my thesis, so it was such a long time ago. But, you know, that's kind of what my passion was. But I just felt that I really had a knack for fundraising and corporate sales and just that external piece. So I was able to work under Coach Hayes and Skip Perkins, and while I was at Central, and, you know, graduated in 2008 with my master's and took an internship. I thought I was going to come out making all this money. Like making $50,000 was like my, I don't know why 50,000 was like the thing for me to come out with my master's degree. I have to hit that number. But I was probably making more as a grad student because I was teaching at Jordan High School. I was bartending, waiting tables at P.F. Chang's, and I was a GA. So I was probably making more money in grad school than when I got my master's and took a job with Women Leaders in Wilmington for $18,000. So, but it puts things in perspective. You have to, my dad told me that, you know, while you're young, this is when you put the work in. This is when you grind it out. You know, you have people who can support you. You can afford to work three jobs now. You don't have any responsibility. So this is when you go hard. And I knew that I needed to take the job at Women Leaders because I needed to build my network. You know, I knew certain people through playing basketball. I knew more coaching and coaches and different things, but I needed to know more administrators. So that's kind of how, you know, working and going to North Carolina Central really helped me hone in on what I wanted to do in athletics. I knew I always wanted to stay in it, but I didn't really know where and what capacity. And when I got there, I said, okay, I know I want to be an AD. That's, you know, AD by 40. That's my goal. That's what it is. I want to be an AD by 40. So how, what's my trail? How do I career map to do that? And, you know, I felt like fundraising, external relations was the best way to go about achieving that in that time frame, because I feel like if you can raise money, you're going to always have a job. You're going to always have, be valuable and be able to bring something to the table. So my career just pretty much took off from there. Worked at Women Leaders through an apprenticeship. They wanted me to stay on, but I wanted to get on the campus. And from there, I got a job at DePaul University in Chicago and was there for 3 years. You know, love DePaul, but it's a place where people don't leave. It's very similar to Carolina. People are there 20, 30 years. They just don't leave. And so I got bored. I joke and say I was kind of, you know, after I did all my tasks, I was online shopping by three. And so it was like, you know, I had to figure it out. And one of my friends, I had did the Charles Whitcomb NCAA Leadership Institute, and it really, that was probably one of the best professional development experiences I've ever had. And it talks about your values and what's important to you. And through that process, you know, I knew I wanted to, obviously, faith, my family, you know, wealth is, you know, I'm not going to, people get, you know, all kind of clam up when you say that, but you have to be honest, like what's important to you. And, you know, integrity, working with people who have high integrity and who care and value the student athlete experience. And so that led me to North Carolina A&T, because I felt like if I'm going to support, I know my Eagles got on me for that. I mean, I headed there. I felt like it was a great opportunity for me to go and be a director at a director level. I was the associate AD for development and the executive director of the Aggie Athletic Foundation. And I felt like if I could have success there, that would really solidify me knowing my craft of how to raise money at limited resource institutions. And I tell people, you always have to have a niche. And that was going to be my niche. You know, I know that I'm known for being able to raise money at HBCUs, places that don't have those resources. And that's kind of how I became known in the industry. And that just kind of helped me, you know, throughout my career, got me at Alabama State, And, you know, as a deputy, and then there were some things that happened here internally where I was elevated to interim athletic director. And then from there, I've been the AD since 2018. So I'm coming on my 2-year anniversary as the AD in October. Congratulations. So that's kind of my career path.
Congratulations on that. And I would assume your journalism degree kind of helps you at this, you know, your journalism experience kind of helps you with your, you know, your day to day too.
It does, because you have to be able to tell the narrative, and right. You know, that's huge. And then I think my people in our strategic communication department, they appreciate me because they know I get it. You know, a lot of people don't understand the role of sports information, strategic communication, athletics community, whatever you want to call it now, all these fancy names, but I understand the role. I actually started working with Kyle Serba when I I was in sports information. I hated it. I used to PA Drew's games, and I just like, I really hated it. And so you know, not hated watching y'all play, I just that just wasn't me. It was like, I get so excited, I don't focus. The games are hype. I mean, Central games, I don't know if they're like off the hook, like some of the best fan atmosphere ever. But I just, being a player, I would just get so engulfed in watching the game that I didn't do my PA duty. So and then I didn't want to stat. I liked writing stories, but it was just some long hours. I respect anyone that's an SID, because the hours are just, they're grueling, and you're on the road constantly. So Kyle is the GOAT. Shout out to Kyle Serba. You know, that's where I started in athletics with him. But it takes a special person to be an SID, and I wasn't that special. So I moved over. but no, I think that journalism background, definitely, because you know how to talk. I mean, you know, I did electronic communication, so I know how to, you know, I used to create websites and different things. You know, don't ask me to create a website now, I couldn't tell you. But, it was just certain things that I can bring to the table where not necessarily every AD has had that experience, and then be able to talk to the media, knowing how to articulate and not overshare, but still getting your points across. To me, that's a certain skill that you have to have. So yes, it was very, my degree, people like to joke on Carolina, I did go to class and my degree was earned. Trust me, I got happy when I got B's, because you didn't get a lot of B's in a journalism school. So.
Hey, I'll tell you this, Kyle looks exactly the same.
He does. I'm eight. I was like, what Kyle is doing? He looks exactly the same. Yeah.
Even though you were, you know, at A&T, we got to give you props, because I was reading, like, you raised like $4 million. I was thinking, like, I would just love to see you in that space, because especially HBCUs are talking about fundraising. And so mm-hmm. A guru fundraiser, if you know how to work the room, I would just like appreciate seeing that, just because I know that takes a talent.
And then I was an Eagle, and I went to Carolina, so I didn't go to A&T. I say I'm an adopted Aggie now. I mean, those my people. I was, you know, fundraising is really about relationships, and that's with anything. I think that you have to be genuine. You know, while I went to Central and, you know, I went to Carolina, I genuinely enjoyed, you know, my experience at A&T, you know, working with those student athletes and the donors. I mean, I still keep in contact with a lot of the donors that I met at my time there. And, you know, it really, I think they were one of the institutions that first kind of focused in on, you have to be able to generate revenue. Like, we can't rely on state funds for everything to offset the different costs. You have to put a focus there. So more HBCUs are starting to really look at that. And I think the pandemic is really causing people to focus on not just in athletic departments, but in universities in their totality, HBCUs. It just has not been a focus. And that's where you see some of the HBCUs who are thriving right now. They've made it a focus and a priority at the university level.
Can you talk about or speak to some of like the biggest challenges you faced as you moved your way up through, you know, athletics? Because I was trying to find this stat. There's maybe, it's less than like 15 of women who are even at Power Five as athletic directors, but I feel like it might be less than that as far as like Black women who are athletic directors. So can you maybe the challenges that you faced, kind of like just trying to like get your foot in that door?
Yeah, definitely. I can speak to that. Just being told that you can't do it. I mean, that's something, especially on the external side. You know, most Black females, they're in academics or compliance. If you look at the demographic, that's where most of your minorities are. You don't see a lot of minorities in development, marketing, tickets, you know, facilities. You don't see that. And so I knew that, you know, I would walk into our convention, which is the national convention, it's normally in Orlando, and it was NAD is our group for development, and literally it would be maybe five African-American females in a room full of 400 people. And, you know, so it's being comfortable invading those spaces. You know, I think people have to get past the stigma. You know, our student athletes that you're raising, they're Black. They're people of color. So why wouldn't you have more people of color that's going out there? Because they're going pro. And if they probably feel a better connection or a feel more comfortable talking to someone who looks like them. So, you know, that was kind of my spin on it. Even though I've been primarily at HBCUs, I had a great relationship with my folks at DePaul. I talk to them all the time. I still keep in contact with the donors, the staff there. It's just about relationships. I think people, if they genuinely know that you care about their institution, they're going to support. But, you know, being told no, being told that, you know, you may need to consider something else, you know, and then when you look at the HBCU realm, ageism, you know, I don't think that I'm young, but compared to a lot of my peers, I am a lot younger than them. So it's on top of being a female, it's also your age. And that's something that I've experienced. And on the HBCU realm, it's just that ageism and just, you know, having to watch what you say, because I mean, oh, you're too aggressive. But if I was a man, you wouldn't say that. You know, you're direct. I don't say I'm direct. I don't have time to beat around the bush or to, you know, I'm a direct person. And, you know, I guess knowing your demographic is, well, I'm from Detroit. I'm in the deep South. They're not maybe used to seeing females as assertive as I. So knowing how to flex and how to communicate with different types of people, I think that's something I've gotten better with. It's been a challenge because I'm just like, hey, this is me, it is what it is. But you have to learn how to adapt to your surroundings. And I'm not changing who I am because I'm always gonna be me. I tell people, be you, they'll adjust. But you know, sometimes just, you know, understanding why things may not be going your way, I think that's half the battle, because, you know, it is, people are brought up different, they're raised differently. And, you know, when you come from the Midwest, we do things a little different than the Deep South. And it's even different in North Carolina here in Alabama. So, you know, I've been told, I've gone into Mississippi, I've gone to Birmingham, to parts of backwoods Louisiana where people say, we don't speak to women. They automatically don't assume I'm the athletic director, think I'm a coach, or I don't know, just somebody else but the athletic directors. They're only used to seeing men in that role. And so dealing with that in 2019, 2018, to me, that's ridiculous. But again, when you have people who have never been anywhere else or who only have seen a certain way of doing things, then that's part of educating them that, hey, women, we deserve to be in this space.
Let me ask you this. Being a former student athlete, I just truly believe we're wired differently. If you played any sports, especially, I mean, you know, if you played in high school, that's cool. But if you play like in college and, you know, you played again at a Power Five, the ultimate, you know, me and Drew had dreams of going there. But you played at that level, and how much of, you know, your career experience and how you, you know, like you just said, proving yourself and, you know, they'll adjust. How much do you tap into your, you know, your days playing ball to get you through those days? Because me and Drew always talk about how, like, I always think back to when it was a bad, and it was a lot of bad days being a student athlete, and how, you know, nowadays the job is kind of easy because we were wired for 18 years basically to just go, push through, yep. We're gonna win regardless. So how much of that did you tap in to along your journey?
I mean, Julian, that's a great question. I tap into my former hoop days every day. I tell people that being a former student athlete, I mean, that's why I'm able to do and to lead during a pandemic. Because that's just how we were built. I mean, we have to be able to adjust as student athletes. There's obstacles that come up all the time. There's situations we're not prepared for. So we have to be able to go on the fly. And then mental toughness. That was something my dad taught. You know, I started playing basketball. And actually, I started late compared to, I started in sixth grade. And so mental toughness, you know, never giving up, you know, not listening. And I think television taught me, you know, you can't take stuff personal. People are going to talk mess about you, whether you're doing good or not. But as long as whoever you report to is okay and y'all have a good rapport, I really could care less what anybody else say. And I think that's why, I mean, maybe people will be looking at me, but I don't care. As long as my president is good, I'm good. And, you know, I know that I'm over here always doing the best because, yeah, while you love your institution you work at, it's about your reputation too. Like, I'm going to do a good job because I want to be, you know, known as a really good worker. So, I mean, it's a selfish piece of it, but that's still part of it. And I think, you know, if people can get past of personal sometimes and just look at the work, I think, you know, at a lot of HBCUs, we'd be in a better space because I feel like at HBCUs, everything so personal. Yeah. And I tell people all the time, I don't have to like you to work with you. We have to have a common level of respect, but as some of my teammates I didn't like. That's real talk. And I think that's the team part. That's about being an athlete. It's some of my teammates I didn't like. Like, I was on a team in high school where it was like all the seniors hated like all the underclassmen, but we won a state championship.
Wow.
But that's lessons you don't think of. And I apply that to my work. You know, I don't have to necessarily kick it with you. We'd be best friends for us to get something done. And I think that's why sometimes at HBCUs there's problems because people feel like you have to be buddy-buddy with somebody to do the job. You don't.
No.
You don't. And it's just knowing the common goal.
And buddy, real petty.
You don't like each other at HBCU. Oh,
man. I mean, I like my teammates more than I mean, there was more that we liked than we didn't, but it was always one or two. You'd be like, yo, man,
what's your deal?
Mental toughness, man. I just remember my dad when I was like in elementary school, middle school, he used to start saying stuff to me like, hey man, everybody ain't got nothing having a bad day.
Yeah. And I think that's what sets us apart. I mean, that mental tough. My coach at Carolina used to always, I mean, we'd have to do the mile run. And I hate running. Like, I hate it. I don't, that's why I track just what, I mean, running around a track for no reason. I mean, just keep running. It's just not for me. But I respect those who do it. But that's that mental toughness. We used to get up with ROTC. I think the guards had 6-minute miles. I guess your three players, your small fours had 6:45, and then the bigs at 7.
Yeah.
And I was a tweener, but because they played me at the 5 spot, 4 sometimes, I say, y'all need to give me that 7 minutes. And so I was able to negotiate that. But it's still mental toughness because I'm not a runner. That's not, you know, I can, basketball running and track running are two different things. So, but it did teach you about getting over that mental that you can't. And I just remember as I used to run around that blue track and seeing all those soccer banners, the national championships. Mm. That's mental toughness. That's winners right there. I mean, I would just count them to pace myself to know when I needed to hit my marks so that I could make my mile. But, you know, I think it just goes back and she always say, this is going to have y'all mentally tough. And, like, honestly, I tell people, like, you know, we all get down at times, but you take 24 hours to process it, and you got to move on. And that's just really what it is. You take that 24 hours, you be in your feelings, you be upset, have a moment, then you let it go.
Yes.
Hey, I was listening to Udonis Haslem like a few, it was a while ago from the Heat. He was, when I first came out, I was going to the league, I was about to get drafted, didn't happen, had to go overseas. I was so blown. He was like, you know what I did? I took a bottle of Hennessy, and I just sat in my room, and I was like, I'm going to take this night.
Yep.
I'm going to be in my feelings, right? But tomorrow, I'm going to work.
It's a new day.
Every time something happens, I'll be like, all right, I'm going to take this 5 minutes. Bad, but then I'm about to get back to it.
Hey, I see him say that too. And at the end of the day, I try to tell students too, you know, nobody cares, man. You know what I mean? Like the older you get, everybody's got their own problems at the end of the day. And speaking of that mile, I mean, listen, me and Drew always revert back to how we were paranoid.
Couldn't sleep at night.
Couldn't sleep.
Yeah.
I tell people because we had to run it on the track away from campus a little bit, mm-hmm. and we had to make it under 6. Me and Drew were guards, so we had to make it under 6. You know, they got that BS rule. If you don't make it under 6, you're not in shape to play basketball.
Yep.
I'm like, give me the rock, though, and let's
give me the rock.
This live, you know what I'm saying? But we used to be like sleepless nights, go out there, couldn't eat, hold stuff down. I mean, I missed it my freshman year, and then I made it from then on out. Because, you know, you get older, you're like, okay, I know how to kind of get my groove, but I still was paranoid.
It took me 2 years. I missed it freshman and sophomore years. And then they started threatening scholarships. Like, hey, you might not get renewed. So I had to get my act in order. I had to change my mental. I had to change my mental process because I was like, I can't go back home to Michigan talking about, hey, yeah, I'm off the team because I didn't make a mile. No.
I still remember that day where all we had to do was the mile. That's what we thought. Mm-hmm. Make the mile. We was prepping all night. We got there, knocked the mile out. We walking towards the cars. All right, guys, we got slammed. Man, I almost lost it.
Yes. Yep. I remember that day. They told me, and then they'll say something stupid like, you never know when it'll be overtime. So, you know, okay. Mm-hmm. Get out of here.
But mental toughness.
Mental toughness.
Yep.
And we push through. So can you discuss some of the innovative ways, strategies that you have found to be successful in athletics as far as the art of fundraising and the importance of that? I know you kind of touched on that, but like, can you, without spilling too much of your gifts and your talents and you know, nuggets, how do you kind of navigate that space?
I mean, really fundraising, I got to tell you, relationships, you know, listening is a huge part of it. You know, I really like to listen to what a prospect or a current donor is, what their needs are. I think sometimes people, they want to talk so much or try to tell you how to spend your money, they lose sight of listening to the prospect or the current donor. So, you know, the relationships, listening, trying to, you know, have a list of always what our needs, knowing what the needs of your department is, you know, knowing what the needs of your coaches are. What are kind of, I always tell my coaches, give me your top three. You need to be able to, if a donor, what's your top three? Now, if you can't think of something, they're going to put that checkbook back in there. But I always the top three, like ready to go. And so having that top three is key for your department, as well as knowing what your different sports need. Making sure you have one giving arm. I think at a lot of HBCUs, what I've seen is a lot of different groups that are raising money on behalf of the department. And that's very counterproductive. You know, when I was at A&T, you had one group here, you had another group here, you had alumni chapters there. You have to streamline the process. And the same here, you know, where I'm at now, it's really streamlining the process and having one giving unit for your athletic department and branding that. So people know the Hornet Club, people know the Eagle Club, people know the Aggie Athletic Foundation. They know where to give your money. And then you have to send people cease and desist. If they're out there acting on behalf of the department or the university and they have no formal affiliation, then you have to call those people out, because that's going to make your job harder. And then making sure you say thank you. I believe there's never too many times to tell someone thank you. And you know, you want those donors to keep coming back. You know, you have your annual giving donors who you rely on annually to give. Educating, that's another part of the process. You have to educate people on the importance of giving. You know, in the Black community, we get like to tithe and give to our churches, but people don't think of the same thing when it comes to supporting your institutions. And buying a season ticket is not giving. That's not, you're getting something in return. It's entertainment. So people think, oh, I purchased season tickets. That's not a donation. That's not philanthropy. And so, you know, really just kind of educating people on the why. So a lot of people just don't know. As HBCUs, we've been behind. You know, a lot of your PWIs, your predominantly white institutions, they've been fundraising since the early 1900s, you know, the 20s, the 30s. We just really started fundraising in the 70s. Really kind of putting it. So we're really behind as HBCUs. And so educating your donor base, your alumni, and then making sure that people have good experiences, the students, you have to start when you're on campus.
Right.
You have to start when you're on campus, because, you know, that's going to be key to educating those students so that when they graduate, they understand the process. You don't want an alum, and that's a lot what I heard when I was at A&T. Well, A&T didn't touch me until I was 20, 30 years, or didn't contact me. Until then, you know, I'm removed 30 years from the institution. You have to start and have consistent communication, and keep them in the know of what's going on. So those are kind of some of the strategies to building a fundraising unit, kind of the, you know, your grassroots efforts and how you start that process.
That's cool.
That whole piece of that experience that you have, because I hear a lot of people like, man, y'all want me to get back to this university after?
Right.
It's like, yeah, we do. So.
Yep.
And that say thank you is so important too. I think that's
what yes.
The mark too is, you know, be, you know, if you're the AD or you're the president, you know, say thank you. I mean, you ain't too big time to say we appreciate that and to be mm-hmm. and to be specific where the funds are going to be allocated and used.
Yes. You nailed it. That transparency, Julian, is huge. And a lot of people at HBCUs, that's, they think people are stealing the money. That's why I have to come and tell people, we're not taking your money. Right. This is exactly where it's going. You can designate it to basketball, golf, right, tennis, whoever you want it to go to. Here's a receipt. But that's key, you know, being transparent too.
Yeah.
So as we start this reopening process, and this changes every hour, every day.
Yes.
How do you just, like, you wake up and you're like, okay, boom. How do you just navigate, you know, safety? You got your sports, but then also like your revenue impact. Like, what does that go through your mind as you're thinking these things?
So, I mean, safety is going to always be the top priority. You know, we always operate under, you know, making sure our student athlete safety is at the forefront, as well as our coaches and our staff too. It's always at the forefront of what we do. We did factor in revenue because, you know, we end up, you know, we had to guarantee games. We had some games that we're not going to be able to play. That was huge too. But at the end of the day, safety is always going to come first. And, you know, I hope our student athletes understand that. And we were prepared to receive our student athletes. We actually had a very detailed plan, about a 35-page plan on the return to play for Alabama State. And it went out probably the end of June because our goal was to have our student athletes come back to campus on the 13th of July. And unfortunately, you know, and I understand why our conference, you know, the presidents and the chancellors, you know, made the decision to not have anyone to suspend us, our fall competition, and to not have anyone return so early. So we, you know, the competitor in me was disappointed because I missed sports, but the administrator in me totally understood the reason why. And, you know, I'm glad that we stepped out there as a conference and did talk about the option for this plan in the spring and moving those fall sports to be able to compete in the spring. And now it's just really looking at scheduling and kind of what that looks like, how we move forward. But safety is always going to be first, you know, that's without a doubt, because you don't want that on your conscience, anything that happens. And you want to make sure you're giving your student athletes the right tools to be successful. While we love sport, you know, your life is important. And, you know, our demographic, African-Americans, people of color, we're dying at a higher rate from the coronavirus than our, you know, non-Black peers. So we have to be mindful of that. And that's what I told our fans. If our fans can't understand this move, then I don't know what to say to you guys. Like, I mean, we're looking out for you all too, because a lot of you guys are our seasoned Hornets that come out and support, and you are at a higher risk factor for catching this disease and not getting better from the disease. So,
and you would think the fans would understand that this is not the decision we want to make. Trust, like, we, you know what I mean? Like, you trust that this had to be the last resort.
It's the last resort. And that's where I'm just like, I don't even get frustrated anymore. I just laugh because people aren't in our shoes. So I don't expect them to understand. I think they have a false narrative of what an athletic director or what a coach really does. And it's cool. I've learned that, you know, you can't educate everybody, but at the end of the day, I tell people this was not a fly by the seat, you know, moment that we just said, oh, we're canceling. There was thought. We've been meeting since March, end of February. Once, you know, everything was shut down, we've met as a cabinet at Alabama State every day to talk about plans and replanning and planning again. And I like to say you have to flex and pivot because we've changed so much, but that's what it's about. Because, you know, no one's led in an athletic department, or even student athletes have had to go through this. Like, I feel for them because I don't know. I mean, I would probably be just really upset right now, you know, if we couldn't play. And I get it. I think that's why having someone who's been in their shoes, like, I understand their emotions right now. And we want to make sure we have mental health services available too, because it's not just about the physical health. It's about their mental health too, because I know I'm going a little loony here. Like, just, you know, anxiety because as an administrator, so I can only imagine what an 18-year-old, someone who hasn't even been able, who came into college, let's say a softball student athlete, who came in as a fresh, couldn't even play, still is unknown right now, seeing that you're fall ball and different things, it's just a lot. And so we want our student athletes to know that we have resources. There's resources available, you know, that we have beefed up our resources just so that we can help them be able to have an outlet, because it's hard right now.
Yeah,
I think we talk about this every day. Me and Kate, like, Yeah, we got there's a $1 billion bubble right now. It's like it's not even like a guarantee. And then we always talk about this, the college athletes, like we like, okay, like the Trevor Lawrences, they're gonna be fine. They're gonna be all right. We always talk about like what about like you know saying like the person who is set out and it was like trying to get the chance, and that is going to be a log jam as far as like, come back on. And so we always like just be thinking like, man, everybody should just reclassify, red shirt and do all this stuff, but then that's when the dollars really start to add up because
it's expensive. And I mean, luckily we were able to accommodate, you know, those requests from our spring student athletes. You know, some of them just were like, we're going to just go on with our, you know, their lives. And they had grad school lined up. So they, you know, weighed and thought about everything. And so we were able to accommodate the ones who did, and we were going to anyway, but you can determine what dollar value you want to bring those back. Right. And so we were able to get our spring sports back, but it's just, you know, if you do that, that's more for the fall. And then you look at your roster cap. So there'll be more legislation that has to come out. So it's a crazy time right now.
Any question? This your senior year. What would you do? Would you come back, or would you be like, you know what, fam? I'm just going good. Just
so I took 5 years because I loved undergrad so much. So I would probably come back. You know, I would just, hey, you know, you have all the time to go get a real job and to figure it out. I didn't know. I didn't have grad school lined up. I knew I needed a break from school, from my high school time. It was very intense. My high school, the high school I went to college. So I knew I was not going straight into grad school. And so I would just go ahead and take another year if I was a senior.
I'd have been out of there. But that's all. We don't have time to go into that.
I would have stayed. I would have came back.
Let me get my meal. Let me get my three meals in the calf. Let me get my little off-campus check. I'm coming back. So
y'all covering swipes too? Oh, okay.
Yeah, swipes. Let me get them swipes. Yep.
You seem, and I could tell by your vibe and your energy, and you're one of three people, maybe only two people that I know that from Detroit. And all of y'all, everybody I know from Detroit, I ain't but two or three people. Have like this great energy vibe about them. Cause you were born and raised in Detroit, right?
I was born there. We moved to the suburbs when I was sixth grade. So pretty much, but my family's all in Detroit.
Okay, cool. One of my good friends, I'm talking about Mike Moe, Drew. Mm-hmm. He's from Detroit, Mike Moses. And we met when we used to work together at a Federal State, and he was the coach or assistant coach there and whatnot. But anyway, you seem to have a really good vibe, and I know your student athletes love you. Seems like you got a great relationship with them. How important is that for you to have those relationships, especially with this younger generation? Because, you know, we're getting older and the students we serve are getting younger. And, you know, why do you think that a lot of student athletes, well, I don't know if it's a lot, but every time you see turn on ESPN, it seems like student athletes are transferring. Can you talk about your relationship with your student athletes, the importance of that, and why do you think so many student athletes are transferring?
Yeah, I do think that this generation relationships, again, are big. They want to know that you care, and they want to know that you have their back. And so I like to tell my student athletes that, hey, we have an open door policy here. But you know where to start first. You know, you go to your head coach, if that, and you have a sport administrator. And then if you need be, then I'm here for you. But we are here for you guys. And that's why I think it's important for us to be visible on social media. I interact a lot with my student athletes on social media, and, you know, I don't follow them to spy on them. I mean, like, most of the time they befriend me. I'm very select too on some of them. I'm like, are you an upperclassman? Okay, you can come, but no. But yeah, so like, I just do it to make sure they understand you're human too. And I think that, you know, being a former student athlete, I think that resonates with them. I do think that a lot of kids transfer now because I think it's a two-way street. I think a lot of kids think it's just the grass is greener on the other side and they don't want to stick it out. You know, it's not going to always be, you know, happy-go-lucky. You're not going to always have a great experience. Like, I thought about transferring my sophomore year when I got benched, but I thought about it and I'm like, I really like it here. They have my major, you know, some good people. Like, I'm going to just have to change kind of what I do. You know, I can only control me. And so, you know, but I think kids just – the portal now has made it so easy. It's really convenient now too. Yeah. So I think it's a two. I think coaches have to do a better job of developing relationships. You talk about a player's coach. I think there has to be more player coaches, because, you know, kids today, they need that. They need to be coddled. They need to be talked to. And I'm not saying that we were stronger back in the day, because I had some teammates that you got to know your personnel. The right. Same as with any being a leader. Like, there's some players you can yell at. There's some that you cannot. You have to talk to them different. That don't mean you don't love the other one, you know, any less, but it's just a way you communicate, because some of them can't handle that. So I think really just kind of knowing the kids you're recruiting and knowing, you know, if they're a fit. I'm really big on fit. Some kids, you know, they just not the best fit for Alabama State. And the same with the coaches, you know, it's just not a good fit. And that doesn't mean that you're a bad coach or a bad player. This just isn't the right fit. And that to me comes down with why people leave too.
Yeah. The best players coach that I think in today's game, well, best I've seen in a while, is Dawn Staley. Mm-hmm. I work at the University of South Carolina, and she's like the mayor around here, basically. She's, yep. She's just, but her relationship with the players, and it's just a great balance of, I'm with you, but you're going to respect me. You're going to do what I yep. tell you to do, but I'm fun too, and I love you, but this mm-hmm. is how we're going to run this machine. And her players, I mean, we got the number one recruiting class coming in again this year. And a lot, large part of that is because I think she's like the perfect players coach. Like them women know when I come here, I got Dawn, who's an Olympian.
Yep.
You know, Hall of Famer, potentially. I don't know if she's in. I'm not sure if Dawn is in the Hall of Fame, but maybe she should be. But she was on Martin, you know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. She's cool.
Yeah. She's changed the culture. I remember South Carolina was trash. I mean, they were not good. And so it talked, you know, her, she's really come in and changed the culture, but it takes time.
Yes.
You're not going to change the culture overnight. And I think, you know, we talk about HBCUs and PWIs, you got to give people chances. Like, you know, the turnover at HBCUs from presidents and chancellors on down, it's unbelievable. And so when you talk about, yeah, it's average, it might be two. And so, you know, when you talk about people investing, if I'm a corporation, I'm not investing in a university that's had a president every other year. Mm. That's just not good for business. And so it's not, you know, so I think that, you know, understanding that it takes time to change culture, and that, you know, if you get that right person there, some amazing things can happen, because Dawn didn't inherit a gold mine. She didn't walk into I mean, South Carolina wasn't known for basketball. I know when I was playing, they were not. And so, you know, but now look what she's done, a national championship. I mean, top classes. I think this may be her second or third top recruiting class, Final Fours. I mean, she's definitely a player's coach.
Yeah. She just solid. You know what I mean? She just solid. I mean, that's the best
thing. I got to ask you this. It's randomly, but they're not too crazy. So you're from Detroit. Did you get a special pay for play with Christian Dawkins?
I did not.
Okay. Now you that, because it is.
What is it called? Pay for play?
Pay for play scheme. It's just just breaking it down, the whole Christian Dawkins background. But like, we're all hoopers, so basically we grew up knowing like the rankings and stuff. He had created his own ranking system and ranked himself, but like was really making money off, like people were paying him for like his, it was like legit.
Wow.
It was just one of those things that's like, are you from Michigan? So you got to have seen it.
I got to say, I'm like, look, you got that on my list. I don't Netflix out, so I'm going to add this.
Because like, it's talking about the whole Sean Miller, Arizona, like all that stuff. But the guy.
Wait, this isn't the Adidas. Hold on. Is this the thing with the, yes, I did see that. And he is from Detroit. That's all I was going to say. When you said it, I did. He is the crib. Yes, I do know what you're talking about. Yeah.
It's not like he's some swindler. It's like, yo, this is like, he's like a mad scientist genius kind of like.
He's a geno for real. Like he probably could have maybe a more legal, I mean, route. But like the fact that he came up with the concept, I do know. I remember I came in the middle part of it, so I didn't see it from the beginning. But yes, when you saw, I said, this is the Adidas.
It's a classic. I'm probably gonna watch
it. It's a classic. I'm probably gonna watch it again so I can catch it.
I'm still gonna watch it. I
gotta ask you, just because you hooped that up, you hooped at the Holy Grail, and so we have seen coaches like, man, it's not looking good for them. And then we've had coaches to where something might happen to where we're like, yeah, I'm not surprised that happened. Now you don't have to say anybody's name or anything like that, but were you surprised that maybe one of the former coaches at your institution to us was like a Hall of Famer, like just legacy as far as like they got they went on their way pretty fast when stuff started rolling. Like, could you see that, or did you understand that happening?
If you okay, so let me make sure I'm following you. At Carolina.
Yeah.
I think it was just some internal things. Just again, fit. I think some personalities didn't mesh quite well. And you know, unfortunately, I think that I would have rather there been a better way for that person to be celebrated leaving out, because it was definitely deserved. Yeah. I think that's where a lot of the players are a little disappointed about, regardless of what happened. And we don't know. I tell, there's always three sides to a story. Yeah. We don't know that and I think that the players never really got an explanation. It was kind of hearsay. So, you know, again, transparency, but I do think that was more about an internal battle than what was put out there. But again, I'm on the outside looking in. Wasn't privy to any information.
So. Yeah, if I would have went to that on the compliance director and some of the things, I was getting called, baby.
You said I didn't get any. I try to being that I'm in athletics, it's kind of, you know, touchy. But things happen. And like I said, I just wish that it could have been, that person could have been celebrated a little more. And it didn't have to come how it came in terms of.
Even I didn't like want to see that, but that's, you know, just the time. But so this is kind of getting to a little more of a somber topic kind of. But what were some of your thoughts and feelings when you kind of saw the whole, you know, George Floyd, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, just the atmosphere, you know, seeing as far as in your area?
I mean, I was angry. I was very upset. I remember watching, I watched the video and I just couldn't believe what I was seeing of George Floyd. Like, I literally called my SWA, and we, you know, she has two sons and younger sons, and I have a daughter. We were less like, this is out of control. And, you know, I'm in Montgomery, Alabama, the birthplace of the civil rights movement. So we knew our kids. We're going to have an opinion. We teach them to speak up and to, you know, just to do it the right way, though. We want to make sure, we knew they were protesting. A lot of my student athletes did protest. But again, we emphasize to them, you know, be smart. You represent not just your family, but you represent Alabama State, too, and the department. So peaceful protesting and just watching your back, because some protests were a little more heated than others. It depended on what part of the country. I mean, we have student athletes from all over the country. So I'm just trying to keep a pulse on them. So, you know, while you're encouraging them to express themselves, you're still nervous as an administrator, because you don't want them to get hurt as, you know, innocent bystanders, because you just, it was crazy. But I mean, my initial reaction was I was just extremely disappointed in our, you know, just in people. I tell people, just be kind. It was just, to me, it was not, it's a way to diffuse a situation, whether resist or hack, you know, there were questions about, you know, he should, it's still, that was unnecessary force. And I just feel like there was a better way to diffuse the situation. And for, you know, this has been happening. Like I say, I'm nervous to drive in certain parts of Alabama, certain parts of Mississippi by myself. I don't drive in, and Louisiana. So, and Texas too. So, I mean, you know, a lot of the places where the SWAC is represented, I just will not, you know, drive by myself, because it's, you know, I've been, you know, racially profiled in some area, Louisa Parish. I don't even know. I was trying to get to one of our golf championship, and, you know, the cop pulled me over and he was in front of me. But like, how do you do that? Like, it was just, and then wanted to stay and like, okay, he gave me the ticket. I didn't ask any questions because I knew I was going to appeal it and get my lawyer. And so, but then he waited, like he literally, I was not leaving. He literally just waited there trying to like intimidate me. And I had to call 911. You know, like, I don't feel comfortable. And luckily I got someone, a person of color, on the phone, and they called whoever his senior person and told them to leave, because that was harassment. You've given me my ticket. There's no need for you to sit here. You know, you said I was speeding, but you were in front of me. So how was I speeding? But okay. So it's just things like that. I think people that are not, you know, African-American, that they don't have to think of, you know, I know that I make sure that, you know, I'm not in certain parts, rural parts, I'm not driving at night. And, you know, my husband tells me all the time, you know, Jennifer, because I have a lot of questions. And so when I have questions, and he was like, you know, you got to chill out on the questions. And I'm just like, but I really be wanting to know. And I don't think that me, if you know, if I was white, I feel like, you know, I could ask those questions. And, you know, being a person of color, I shouldn't have to think twice about asking my questions. Right. And you do. And, you know, when I go to Prairie View to drive past the Sandra Bland Memorial, it's extremely sad. You know, it's extremely sad. They have a memorial right when you enter campus. So, you know, it affected me, you know, and it, I know it affected our student athletes because they reached out to me. And, you know, I had things to say on my Twitter account. I talked to my coaches immediately. I said, you need to check off. Everyone needs to check in on their student athletes. And I gave, you know, we had a meeting to make sure they were good because a lot of my coaches weren't good.
Right.
You know, they had experiences themselves. So, just, you know, everyone, you know, we have to take a woo-sigh and just, you know, again, check our mental, because we have to be mentally strong so that our student athletes can focus. And I want to make sure they were healthy to be able to have conversations with their kids, because not only do we serve student athletes of color, I have a lot of non-Black student athletes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so it's different conversations, and they have to understand that their teammates are hurt, but this doesn't mean that we're excluding them too.
Right.
We love all of our, so we're all a family, but right now some of your family members are struggling, and that they have to understand the why. Again, educating. And I think that you have a lot of people at Power Fives or other institutions, they don't consider that, yeah, we may be a historically Black institution, but we have white student athletes. We have staff that are, you know, white, Latino. And, you know, this affects everyone. So let's talk about it. And so our coaches have been, where they were phenomenal in the process. Our president was great. He put out a piece on it. So, but it was sad. You know, we have a long way to go. We really have a long way to go. And I just hope that, you know, people, because you see a lot of these student athletes at predominantly white institutions talking about, oh, HBCU, I'm coming. I just want to make sure they understand why they're coming, for the right reasons. Don't come because it's the it thing to do, because, you know, you look at your staff now and your coaches, and, you know, then that's, I guess that's my thing. Like, I went to a PWI. I never once felt like I couldn't be me at Carolina, because immediately if I did feel that way, I would have probably left. And that's why I stayed, because we all had options to train. I never felt that. Now, I did feel like there needed to be more African-American students there, because outside the athletes, when I went there in my first 2 years, it just wasn't. Now, it got better my junior, senior year in terms of the student body, but we still had our family with those athletes. And so that was kind of our group that kept us up, but I never felt like I couldn't go on campus and not be me. And that's something, when I hear student athletes at PWI say that, I'm just like, that's tough. That's tough. And that's why, and that's why representation matters. You have to have people in your department that look like you.
Yes. Yeah.
Not the janitors and people that work in the cab.
Right. not them. And it's nothing against those folks, but you need people that's at the table, mm-hmm. that's really in leadership positions, who look like those student athletes that you're recruiting, that you guys are getting those endorsements and them television deals. Like, you need those people at the table.
One of those first people I saw was Skip.
Right, exactly.
Hey, like, yo, be a Black dude, he cool.
He cool, yep. Former student athlete.
Okay, that's what's up, man.
Yep.
Yeah, he played tennis.
He's a tennis player.
He was still, like, cool, like, all right.
Man. Yeah, real cool, yep.
Yeah,
but
you said something, though, just be kind. I mean, I mean, it's frustrating. Whether you're Black, white, green, purple, or whatever, I think if you have a heart and if you're empathetic in any way, when you see that level of hate, that murder, how can you start thinking, like, how can you even do something like that? Like, forget the, let's just throw the Black and white out. Just mm-hmm. But, you know, white, you know, not to get too crazy, but you got some people out here that care more. If I always look at it like this too. If that was a person kneeling on the neck of a dog, because, you know, people
would go crazy. They love their dogs.
Oh, come on now.
Michael Vick.
You know what I'm saying? Like, people would be going, there would be no questions asked. What they wouldn't be asking if the dog bit him, if the dog did this, what did the dog do? Yep. But when it's a Black man being murdered, you know, you got people, well, what did he do?
What did he do? That's not the point. And that's my whole thing. Like, regardless of what he did, he didn't deserve to die.
No.
No, and not like that. You know, it was one. Then you had people come to the rescue, like, hey, get off him. And you still just, that to me was like, come on, you had an opportunity, multiple opportunities. And so just be kind. And like you said, I feel like if you couldn't understand why people were upset after watching that video, then you need to reevaluate what you have going on. Because to me, it was clear, like, it was hard for me to watch that. I was speechless. I just was like, what? This is 2020.
I didn't think it was real. When I first saw it, I was like, this isn't real. Somebody cropped this. Somebody did some, you know, graphic stuff. This didn't happen like this.
Yep.
But it did.
We're talking about a potential counterfeit $20 bill.
Right. Allegedly.
Allegedly.
And we had our boiling point just because every time at the house, we have this mental checklist. Okay. All right. Do I look threatening? No. I have this my ID here. Is it not in the glove part where it looks kind of to be threatening?
Right.
It was just like, man.
It's crazy. Yeah. It's tired. It's exhausting. And then, you know, Breonna Taylor, they still haven't made any arrests with that. And I'm just like, you know, I don't understand the why. Like, you're sleeping, and why does it have to take that many shots? Why do you shoot to kill? I don't understand, like, but.
And then you see videos where other races, primarily white, are just talking cash money to the police officer, or hitting them or threatening them. And all of a sudden they have all the training, they tap into it. They have this level of patience, and we don't want, I mean, the thing that happened in Missouri with those people, with those, that couple, the white couple that had the guns, pointing guns at protesters. I mean, you know, nobody, there was no kind of thing, but if that had been black, we all know what would have happened. But we gotta move on, because we don't want to turn this into something like that. This is a love day. So you kind of just touched on it, but you see all of these student athletes, high school student athletes, or just student athletes in general, just talking about, you know, going to a HBCU. The kid Mikey Williams, who's I think is only a sophomore, talked about his top 10 list or whatever, and there's like 3 or 4 HBCUs in there. It's like the hot trending thing to do. But now, I do believe it's a trend, but I also think some of these student athletes mean it. Go ahead, Drew, what were you gonna say?
Alabama State, they got one. They got like a top.
Okay.
And well, Mikey has us in NCCU on his list, so
let's pray that happens, because kid ain't gonna be there but 8 months. Let's just
right. But he might as well come here for 8 months than go to Carolina or Duke.
You know what I'm saying? And Bolt, I think the kid that just did it announced he was going to Howard. What's his name?
Howard. Drew? Yep.
Yep. Bowl or something like that. But he's a top 5 recruit. Yep. But anyway, how do you think that could change the dynamic of HBCUs? And you just hired a guy that's around my age, and he killed me. We played in high school at Las Vegas Big Time Tournament, and he was playing for the Alabama, forget the name of the AAU team, but you just hired Mo Williams, who we all know, you know, probably better than us. We followed him, NBA guy. How do you think him being there will impact your student athletes, or what kind of success do you think he will have?
Great question. So about the trend that we're seeing, you know, these 5-star, 4-star, 3-star recruits starting to really consider HBCUs, I think it's great. I think it can definitely help elevate the brand, the profile, get more media, not just our HBCU media who we're super grateful for, right, but really get people looking at historically black colleges, because I'm on a lot of committees through the NCAA, and I still just think people don't understand what it is that we have to, you know, go through on a day-to-day. Not understanding that we are a Division I institution too, and that we're able to maintain the status on budgets that are a fraction of some of these other institutions. So it takes a lot to attend and to work at HBCUs, but it's so rewarding. What I hope is that people and student athletes who are looking, considering this route, that they really understand the why and understand the institutions they're considering, that they're not doing it for a trend, because it's so much history. It's so much that our institutions are built on. Just great tradition, as well as athletic You know, we have a lot of tradition and a lot of, you know, when it comes to championship programs, there are. And up until what, the 60s, when, you know, PWI started letting Black people come in, that's where all your athletes were. Yeah. This was the only choice, and this is where they went. But I do think it's about fit. You know, HBCUs aren't for everybody.
Right.
And just like PWIs aren't. You know, I hate to hear the PWI versus the HBCU debate. And maybe I'm impartial because I went to both. But I think there's value in both institutions. I'm big on people diversifying themselves and just seeing all different, you know, walks of life. And then making a determination of what best works for you. And I think that's why I'm so comfortable working at HBCUs, because it's, to me, I love it. I think that there's value. And I think you have to get the right people. I know that you have to get the right people in these positions, and it can't be the homeboy hookup. It, you know, the days of the AD being the old, you know, the football coach. And it has to be someone who understands the business, because being an AD is not about, you know, just going to events and shaking hands. It's really strategy to it. And I don't think, and it's managing people. And I don't think people understand. And then in ours, it's raising money. So, you know, it's, I think people get, they have a false narrative when it comes to what it takes, but I hope that student athletes really start to consider. And then our coaches and our institutions, they have to be ready to receive these type of student athletes, you know, and that's where it comes to your staffing. You know, having qualified individuals in key roles. And that's to me being ready to receive, and coaches have to shoot their shot. Like I said, I wasn't, not one HBCU recruited me. When you have places that are outside the South that don't have HBCUs in their radius, you need to go. Like California, I met a girl probably back in 2010, African-American, who never, didn't even know what HBCU stood for, the acronym. So we have to be willing to step out there and try. And now with technology, it's really no excuse.
Right.
When I was coming out, you didn't have all this, you know, Twitters and Facebook. It just came on the scene, and you had to be in college to get one. So, you know, you didn't have all this stuff. But now with Zoom and cell phones and just everything, technology is just so much more advanced that it's no excuses why our coaches can't do this. You can't hear the excuse about money. Is the way to get it done without having to be there necessarily flying there. And you just have to figure it out and be strategic. So that's that. I hope it does happen. I hope it's not just a phase, but I think, you know, that people are seeing, and student athletes are more vocal too.
Yeah.
They're more vocal and they have a platform now. I think that when we were in school, I wouldn't say that we weren't vocal, but we didn't have a platform.
Right.
We didn't have Twitter where we can express. We didn't have all this where we can bring visibility to the problem. These kids are calling these institutions out, and they need to be ready. And if they don't see change, then they're going to leave. And that's when HBCUs have to start talking. It's relationships. Mm-hmm. You got to keep those relationships. That's one thing I remember when I was being recruited. You know, an institution, I was being recruited, Colorado had recruited me probably since I was in like eighth grade. Loved it. But again, they just wasn't diverse enough for me. I wasn't going to a school where I'm the only Black face on a basketball team. I went through that enough in high school. I wasn't, and not my team. My team was good. It was just the school. I just needed some diversity in my life. And so, but they said, hey, if Carolina doesn't work out, you can always, you know, we're here. That's the kind of message we need to say. Hey, if you go to Duke and it don't work out, okay, you can always come to Alabama State. No hard feelings. We understand. But having it, and Shaw did a great job. That was kind of what they did at Carolina. I had a lot of teammates that it didn't work out for them at Carolina. They went to Shaw, Final Fours, Elite Eight, powerhouse. So it's about the relationships and how you establish those relationships. Your second question, hold on, you might have to, you know, I'm getting old.
Mo Williams.
The other Williams. Yeah. Two of them here now.
Yeah.
So people, and we are not related. I had so many people we hired. I'm like, just, we are not related. Not people.
Your cousins. You have
Canadian, not my cousin. No relation. I mean, geez. But I mean, the job was a really good job. And, you know, I think when you look at the SWAC, when you look at what we've done as a program, we are really, you know, we're taking off. We've won our Commissioner Cup 6 years in a row. We're going for 7 in a row this upcoming year. Hopefully we can, you know, have a year, knock on wood. But we are really, you know, we're out there with our brand. So I wasn't shocked. We had a lot of people interested. A lot of other NBA players, former players, had reached out about the job. So he wasn't the only one. Sure. And Mo just was like, I mean, his energy. Right. I'm really big on energy and vibe. And his energy was phenomenal. And he's a winner. I want people that's been around winning and who has won. That's my top thing when I look at. You have to have a winning pedigree. And you have to understand where you're coming to. That was my thing about some of the Power Five coaches who applied, or Group of Five. I need you to understand what it is at HBCU, because you're not going to have everything handed to you.
Right.
You're going to have to work. And Mo was prepared. You know, all of his family, except for him and his brother, they all went to HBCUs. He's from Jackson. You know, he played at Alabama, so he knew.
Yes.
He knew the area. So it just made sense. Yeah. And we just wanted someone, you know, people want a former player. He's won at the highest level. Yes. Why wouldn't you want to come play with somebody like that?
Yeah.
So that was.
And Jennifer, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I think, like, you fast forward to 2022 when Mikey Williams is ready, or 2021, 2022, whenever his class is, you got Mo Williams, who played in the league, played point guard at a high level in the NBA.
Exactly.
With LeBron. So now when Mo goes and say, hey, Mikey, come on, dog. I can show you these tricks. This 15 or however many years vet he was in the league. I got you there. Give me 8 months, big dog.
Just I got you.
I got you.
I think you have to listen to that as a player. Yes. And that to me was so powerful. I mean, why wouldn't you want to go play for him? He's won. He's connected. He can tell you about the league firsthand. He's relatable. You know, extremely relatable. He's, to me, a player's coach. Like, I've watched him, and even though I've watched, you know, some fake tape of him as an assistant, you can tell. And just from talking to him, his energy, he's a player's coach. And I just think our young men are really going to respond to him and the staff that he's gotten there. You know, a really, really good staff he's built. So I'm excited for the program. I mean, I think a lot of people were shocked, but I wasn't. And it's not about an arrogance. You know, I just know that I know what we have here. Right. And I think other people know it. On the outside looking in, you may not know it, but I know the staff that I've put together, and I know the expectations that I've given to our coaches, and we're very transparent and real. And so it was just a really good fit. And we had to do everything virtual. So everything was Zoom. Yeah. You know, there was telephone calls, but he had to feel comfortable too. You're coming from California.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like you coming up the street.
Right. And Jennifer, from Cali. Let me tie this knot for you to give you some hope. So you probably know this, but I'm going to just say this real quick. Mikey played AAU ball with LeBron James' son, if I'm not mistaken, with Bronny, I want to say. Okay. LeBron and Mo won a championship together, right? Okay. You see, do I need to keep going?
I see where you're going. Don't give everybody my secret, our secrets now. You done crafted all these concoctions here.
Okay, I'll chill out. But I'm just saying, that's how things work. You know, you, Mo, hey, LeBron, call Mikey for me. Relationship, call him Mikey.
Relationships.
That's how it goes. So
that's how it goes.
Just want to give you a little hope right there.
Thank you.
If you get three top 50 guys to sign, those TV contracts are coming.
Oh, yeah.
Amenities are coming. The gear is coming. We were a large, by the way.
I got you. I got y'all.
It's easy to get those changes made immediately versus changing the character of somebody. Like, you're seeing, like, guys, like, they talk to us, they make these racial slurs. And so that's really where I feel like HBCUs can take advantage, because we'll get the TV contract. Like,
if they come, you're going to get exposure. I tell people anything. If you're good, people are going to find and seek you out. It's the same if you're an administrator or a coach. If you're good, like, you know, I encourage my coaches, hey, look, if you want to be here for the rest, that's fine. But if you're looking to grow, you got to be great where you're at. You got to be great where you're at, and people are going to come and find you. So it's the same thing as a player. If you're good and you can consistently come in here and shine, you come off the high school circuit, a top player, they're not going anywhere. No. They're going to look.
Yeah.
You'll get a shot.
Mikey's going to the league wherever he goes. He's going to the league. I mean, unless he has something, you know, bad happens or something.
Yeah.
Already written, basically.
Yep. So. That's true.
And you talk about, you know, who were some of the mentors that kind of poured into you. You kind of mentioned Kyle. I imagine, trying to figure out what Miss Ingrid was when you were at Central. She's still a volleyball coach?
She was, yes, I think she was the, you know, what's, okay, well, some, yes, she was my first year, and then she transitioned over to compliance.
Okay, okay.
Yep.
But who were some of, like, the mentors that poured into you, and, like, what was, like, some of the best advice that you got from them?
So I've had a lot of mentors. It's a lot to name, but I will say, you know, the AD that when I was at DePaul, Jean Linty Poncetto, she just actually announced her retirement this year. She was phenomenal. She really was about family. She really knew how to make people feel comfortable. A lot of the people that worked at DePaul were former, you know, they were graduates. I was not. And I felt like that was my family. I still talk to her today. I still talk to that staff. And she would always say to us as administrators, we have to check our egos at the door. And that's something that has stuck with me like to today because, you know, coaches, they're a handful. And as an administrator, it's not even, don't try to go toe to toe with your coach. You got to understand because they're dealing with a lot. As an administrator, you have to check your ego at the door. And so I've always kind of led with that. And then just, she always came from just, she knew how to be stern, but also, you know, that level of femininity and just being, you know, who she was as a female. I always loved that about her. And, you know, I try to have that balance because sometimes it's harder, especially when you're younger. You want to come across as, you know your stuff and you're assertive and this, but you still got to have that balance and put your touch on it. And she knew how to throw her touch on it. And so one of my mentors, you know, Ingrid, she was coming into compliance. I didn't work a lot with Ingrid when I was at Central, but just have watched her through the years. You know, she's doing a wonderful job there. Somebody I do look up to and admire and what they're doing. Tamika Smith-Jones out at UC Riverside is somebody else who's been awesome, just an awesome resource. It's great to have a circle. I think we all learn and give and take from each other, but just having a great circle of men and women. I've had a lot of male mentors too, just being on the development side. People who have really just looked out for me. Larry Gallo, who you know, was at Carolina when I was there. I was on SAC and he was kind of one of the liaisons for that. But just, I've had a lot. I'm grateful for the people who have poured into me, and that's why I'm really passionate on giving back to, you know, those who are trying to be administrators. Well, I can't have everybody on my roster, mentee roster. I try to, you know, I at least try to connect them with people or at least respond, you know, to them because I've had, you know, when I was coming up through the ranks, everybody wasn't as welcoming. And I'm just going to be, you know, a lot of Black females were not open or receptive. And I think they may have felt at the time that they could only be the one. Mm-hmm. And at a lot of places, you know, especially your PWIs, it could be a threat like that. But I look at it like, hey, what's for you is for you. And you got to help the younger, you know, the younger generation. And you should always try to pay it forward.
And it's enough out here for everybody to eat, isn't it?
Exactly.
I mean, at the end of the day. But don't get me started. But listen, last question. What advice, you just talked about your mentee list, but what advice would you give to somebody that's looking to kind of follow in the same footsteps? You know, as hard as it is in your profession and, you know, any working in higher ed in general, I mean, it's not a regular job, but really being in that athletic world, what advice would you give to somebody that's looking to, you know, kind of follow in your footsteps?
I would tell them you really have to love what you're doing. I mean, this is a hard job and you really don't make money until you kind of progress. So you have to really love it. And it's a lot of hours. You know, I always say this, you know, a blossom where you're planted. That's kind of one of the things I've been saying probably since I was a grad assistant. You have to do a good job where you are. And if you work hard, if you operate with integrity, you are just, to me, hard work and integrity. Never want to let anyone outshine you, out hustle you. The same when you were a player. And if you apply that to your work, you're going to have success. And like you say, it's enough out there where everybody can eat.
Yeah.
I really do feel like that, but you also got to be confident in your abilities too. And I think as a younger professional, sometimes you aren't as confident because you're still trying to figure out where you want to be. I think the hardest part is just deciding what facet of athletics you want to work in. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And once you figure that out, then you try to connect with people. You be intentional about reaching out to mentors and stay persistent, because it's not that, you know, sometimes we don't, as mentors, we don't want to help you. We are so busy that sometimes we just genuinely don't see it. So being persistent is good.
Yeah.
You know, but
I guess we had to be like,
Drew was hitting Twitter like that. I was like, I see you, Drew. I'm sorry. It's just a lot going on, but persistent.
That's my
you have to be persistent. And I tell people, I think sometimes people give up.
Right.
Don't give up, you know, keep, if it's something that you really want. Like I said, my goal was to be an AD by 40. I hit it, you know, barely, but no, I hit it. A couple years to spare, but you know, but having those goals, I think you set short and long-term goals, but know that you have to be flexible because things change and it's okay. But having a roadmap, a map as to what you're trying to do, career mapping, to me, that's huge. Still working on my career map too. I'm updating it, but you gotta have those goals, and you have to, I think setting those goals are key too, especially as a young professional.
Yeah. Well, listen, I mean, you hit the nail on the coffin about that work ethic, man. I think me and Drew, you know, I kind of got into higher ed a little bit before him, and I would tell him, I said, man, once you get in, you're going to be dope because you got the personality. You're tall, you're a good-looking guy, so you're going to get that in attention too. But that work ethic that you get from being a – everybody else is going to tire out because they don't understand the way we're wired, and it's happened. It's happened for his career. And so that work ethic and being consistent, though, you know, and still smiling, you know, when you don't want to run that mile and you still got to run that mile and still smiling about it, you know what I mean?
Yep.
That's really that's the day-to-day. That's what we got to do.
That is. I tell them, never let them see you sweat.
Yeah.
And, you know, somebody said to me, you know, it's not all great. I mean, we have our challenges at Alabama State, but they said, you just always so happy. I think that's just, I'm a positive person. You're not going to ever see me, you know, keep your stuff within your family. It's another thing I talk to our student athletes about. If you have issues, talk within your family about it. You don't put people's business in the streets. Right. And, you know, so it's great. I tell people, you know, being an athletic director, to me, it's the best job in the world. I love it, but it's not for everybody. It's really not. And being an administrator in athletics is not for everyone. You have to really love what you do. It's a lot of hours, and you pouring into other people, other, you know, people's kids, and you deal with a lot. And a lot of people don't understand athletics. They think that it's just you show up for a game. There's a whole lot more than just showing up for a game.
That's the easy part.
That's the easy part.
Yeah.
Yep. So
proper prior preparation prevents poor performance.
Look, the six P's, that's another one. That's my proper prior planning. My coach used to always say that prevents poor performance. And I still apply that. I feel like anytime you prepare, you over prepare, there's no way you're not going to be successful. It's just to me, it's no way. Like, and I've had that since 18. She said that at 18 when we walked on to that campus.
Tell me if I'm tripping, both of y'all guys. So when you think about that in your head, does that not bring you back to just your scouting report days? Like, okay, boom. This is what I'm doing.
Yes. And I just remember looking at the rebounds. You know, I'm in a post and all them missed little circles. That's how you count up them, the suicides you got to do.
It's just like, I feel like we have like the game plan. So it's almost, that's why I say it's kind of like easy, because we've just been so in tune to doing this that it's just, we're in now, as far as we've already done all that stuff, but just continue to try to get better because competitors in us. So
yeah, that's very true.
Listen, we certainly appreciate you. And I got to plug us real quick. As soon as this COVID is over, you know, me and Drew can come down to Alabama State and rap to your student athletes. We could pick up some t-shirts too.
I'm gonna tell Coach Williams to get y'all some exclusives.
There you go.
I'm hearing through my Adidas people, he got some fire coming.
But we appreciate you. This was dope. We appreciate you sharing your wisdom and dropping some gems, and you know, stay safe out here, and good luck the rest of the year. I know it's gonna be a trying fall semester, but I know you equipped to handle everything that's coming your way. So We fans of Alabama State for sure now.
Yay. Yay. Thank you. Thank you. And I appreciate you guys for having me. This was fun. I enjoy doing podcasts like this, and hopefully, you know, what we've shared can help somebody and inspire some people who may not be in the best space right now, or who just don't know what to do in terms of certain questions that was asked. But thank you all for having me on here, and I appreciate you guys. And when you ever decide to come to Montgomery, I got you guys.
we're gonna hit you up as soon as COVID up. We'll send you your email or something. We'll be in touch.
All right.
All right. Take care,
Jennifer. Thank you guys. Have a good night.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye.